This is the April 8th statutory interpretation regulatory practice class. We have left statutory interpretation behind, are now wading in about knee deep onto agency practice, regulatory practice. Our first class in this topic on Monday broached a couple of very important fundamental topics that are going to come up again and again in our last month together. Namely, we talked about the core concept of once you've written the statute, how do you implement the darn thing? And we talked about some basic choices the legislature can make, some of which you know from your other classes, you know, using criminal or civil liability, citizen suits, enforcement options. But the one that has increasingly become the almost overwhelming default is creation of administrative authority for an agency to enforce and implement the statute. We talked a little bit about what an agency was and what sorts of things might fall on the line, such as, for example, judiciary, of course. But then, moving on, I then talked a little bit in passing about some fundamental constitutional issues that really were meant to highlight an issue in terms of what types of agencies we're wrestling with. In other words, remember I talked about the idea that there are limits on how an executive branch could yank the agency heads out of positions of leadership. And that in part, while the president has specific authority in the Constitution to fire executive agency heads, Congress has its own legislative power to create agencies that are insulated to some extent from political interference. That has led to the evolution of executive agencies versus independent agencies. And we talked a little bit about some of the hallmarks of independent agencies versus executive agencies. And then I talked to you a little bit about the sad case of Dr. Moreira Erazo and what's happened to the Civil Safety Board to illustrate how even independent agencies may also become subject to rather significant pressure on how they operate by the political branch. We then talked about a little bit the Administrative Procedure Act. And yes, you will get to know it intimately. It will be a dear friend by the end of the semester. Remember Appendix C. You have the option of just leaving to the back of the book where you need to find an answer because the APA usually has it. However, I also pointed out in passing that states have their own Administrative Procedure Acts, including Texas, and we'll be coming back to that again as we go along. In that respect, the APA dictates two fundamental ways agencies go about the process of creating rules. One was formal procedures, similar to those trial-type proceedings. And that's when we talked a little bit about the U.S. versus Florida East Railway case, and yet another Rehnquist Railroad opinion, and about how the adjudicatory process can be used to provide guidance on how agencies will implement a statute. By contrast, we talked about notice and comment rulemaking, which is radically different. It is not designed to decide on a case-by-case basis with sensitivity to the particular facts. It is basically one for all. And the Administrative Procedure Act sets very clear requirements that agencies have to go through to promulgate notice and comment rules. And remember, we talked about publication in the Federal Register. We talked about that the proposed rule must first be published. We talked about that there has to be an opportunity for the public, anybody, including us in this class, to provide comment on that rule. You don't need any kind of standing. You don't need any kind of injury. Anybody can comment on the rule. Then, once the period closes, the agency takes the comments and goes behind closed doors and processes them and reviews the proposed rule in light of those comments. Then, as part of that process, it proposes again in the Federal Register a final rule. The final rule must explain the basis for the agency's decision. It must show where the final rule varies from the proposed rule. They must explain in a concise way why it made the changes. And that's when we talked about the Nova Scotia food products case with the wonderfully appealing image of baked whitefish turning to goo or containing botulism. But that was a case very much about whether the agency had gone through proper notice and comment rulemaking when it had failed to respond to particular comments. And when there are allegations that it had also not discussed the basis for some of its decisions to require treatment of whitefish, even though it destroyed its commercial value, even though there were special facts about the whitefish containing botulism made much less of a risk. But most importantly, that court also, for the first time, highlighted the standard of review courts will use in looking at notice and comment rulemaking. And basically, it has to be on the record. Remember how we talked about that there's a sealed bubble? The universe of the agency's decision is solely the record created by the process that generated the rule. The agency can't waltz in after the fact and add to the record while it's before the court. The agency can't meander behind the podium and say, oh wait, here's another reason that I didn't mention when we published the final rule. It has to rely strictly on what's in the record, and it has to provide us reasoning for the rule at the time it publishes the rule. And that was what Nova Scotia was all about. You can't ad hoc rationalize the rule. We talked a little bit about where that creates a problem with infinite regress. In other words, if you respond to the comments and the final rule is different, do you have to then repropose the rule? In general, it has to be enough of a major change to the rule that it almost is effectively a new rule. The courts don't require you to go back again and again to the well. So, with that, a deep breath. Any questions about that first foray into the way agencies take statutes hot off the press and turn them into compulsory binding norms for conduct? All right? Because now we wade a little deeper today. Now we're going to talk in greater detail about two of the aspects of the way agencies create those norms. We're going to talk a little bit more about the fact that agencies can use adjudicatory rulemaking. A little bit of a repeat from yesterday, but we're going to go into greater detail on exactly when and how that happens, and when the agency has discretion to choose that route, when it can elect to go either notice and comment or adjudicatory rulemaking. And then we'll go and finish up the class with an area which I will tell you is incredibly active. We are fortunate to have a new Supreme Court decision from just last month on this topic. And I will also tell you as a practicing lawyer that I have taken many a whipping on this point as to whether or not an agency is acting when it does a rule, a notice and comment rule, or whether or not it's just simply saying it's just guidance. This is just an interpretive rule. This is just a generalized statement of policy. The APA, once again, treats those two baskets incredibly differently. As an advocate, you will find yourself in a very different position if the agency succeeds in putting it in the box it wants as opposed to the one that your client wants. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in then on the first things, first basket for today, which is adjudicatory rulemaking. And the bottom line here is, remember from Monday, agencies can create rules by either going through the Federal Register Notice and Comment pathway, but intriguingly, historically, the way it was usually done, the agency can act like a court. The commissioners can convene, or the agency can create its own administrative legal decision or ALJ process, and essentially do it case by case. The APA doesn't prohibit that. And if you go back to pre-World War II, that was the way it was done, overwhelmingly by default. Most major agency decisions were done in this sort of contested proceeding procedure, where you would have the lawyers arguing before the commission. No notice and comment. And also, the agency, many times, would take these cases as an opportunity to set agency policy or change agency policy. The APA allows them to do that textually. Of course, having said that, the real proof is in the details. So today we have a case, which is one of those ones you might want to put a star by because it's one of those ones referred to by name. This is one that you will find pop up repeatedly in the world of administrative law. Chenery, SEC versus Chenery. It's actually two cases baked into one. You've got the second one. But it highly, that's a terrible way to say it. It clearly illustrates the concepts we're going to be talking about. So with that in mind, we sort of have once again, the reading panels seem to be distributed in very strange ways. They're all clustered together. And today, we all seem to be right in the middle of the room. So Harrison, once again, you know I go left to right. That means you draw the short straw and get to go first. Could you give us a quick rundown on Chenery 2? What's going on here?
Yeah, so for two cases before the court held that a reorganization order of the SEC wasn't sustained because the ground the agency was acting on was past judicial action. And so when that remanded, the SEC reexamined the problem and they reached the same result, but they're bringing it now for different grounds.
Well, and before you dive into the thing we really care about, you know, every case has two levels, the substance, but also how it got there. We usually focus on how it got there, because that's just the nature of statutory interpretation, regulatory practice. This is one of those rare beasts. This is the unicorn for the semester. This is a genuine corporate law case. I know some of you actually want to do transactional and corporate law work, so it's worth a quick pause. I'm just kind of curious, how many of you found the description of what the corporate officers and directors were doing in this case virtually impenetrable? It's like, what? Yeah, everyone found that pretty quick. Oh, good, a couple, Anastasia, thank you, I appreciate you, okay. Oh, Donna too. All right, so now let me flip that around. Who here is just dying to go to Wall Street and be a corporate lawyer and wants to sort of give a quick rundown on exactly what was that? Why you care about whether or not board and officers and directors were acting this way? Now, normally I would have called Donna, but I know you've already held your hand up saying this is a ridiculously, archaically, densely written provision. I would agree. Anyone else? Because otherwise, I'll jump in. Beat, I might pick on you, but I know it's okay. Anyone else who's foolishly volunteered they're interested in corporate law? Okay. Let me rephrase the question with the virtually guaranteed amnesty here. How many of you are thinking about taking this org? What's going on, guys? All right, what we're talking about here is a common issue. And by the way, side comment, and I'll even put this on the record. Doug Maul's class is one of the best here at campus. Take it if you can. But be prepared, it fills up like that. Having said that, what we're talking about here is a special case, but it deals with the fundamental issue that cuts across in all cases of to what extent do officers and directors of a company owe a duty to their shareholders to treat them fairly. This is a kind of a special case because what we're dealing with here is a public utility, which means there is a much greater degree of oversight of their internal workings. This is not only a public utility, this is a public utility holding company, which means it has other utilities nestled under its wings, which makes it even more important how it's run. Not only that, it's a public utility holding company undergoing reorganization, which under the statute gives the board of officers and directors enormous powers to shift the pieces around and put the company into a more viable state. Here the question is, are they allowed, the board and officers and directors, allowed to buy stock in the company that they're recreating? Not only that, are they allowed to buy stock that they know, even though it is being priced cheaply because it doesn't have voting rights, that they're going to flip later and turn into voting stock, and essentially reap the benefit after the reorganization? It kind of smells a little fishy, doesn't it? You can see why the courts were kind of going, or the SEC was kind of going, wait a minute. And what we have here as a result is two cases challenging that. And now, Harrison, I'll come back to you. Now we know what's going on. Basically, are utility holding company officers and directors fleecing the shareholders of the company for their own benefit? Well, that's perhaps a little bit too much of a spin, but it gives a little flavor of what's going on. What did the SEC, the court, decide at this point?
Sorry,
let me rephrase that. What did the court decide at this point in light of the SEC's actions?
They said that, they upheld the SEC's actions and their ability to create rules at this point.
Which time?
Or the current case.
Right, because remember, this is two for one. You guys get the benefit of having an earlier decision synopsized for you by the Supreme Court of the United States. That's pretty cool. That saves you a lot of outlining work right there. So what, very briefly, happened to Chenery 1?
Well, the first time when the SEC was saying that the company couldn't do this, they were basing it on judicial decisions, principles of equity, and so the court said that they couldn't do that, but then the second time they're coming back and they're looking at it in the light of the Holding Company Act, and the court said that was all right.
All right, so pretend that I don't understand, which is actually probably not too bad if we're pretending at this point. Case number one, the agency says, we've read the court decisions interpreting the statute. In light of those decisions, we believe the Board of Officers and the Department of Revenue, they have a fiduciary duty, which I'm assuming all of you know what fiduciary duty is. It's come from your classes yet. I see someone nodding their head in the back. Yes, you have talked about that in other classes?
Last year.
Last year you were in law school.
Yeah, no, I
transferred. Okay. All right, that doesn't count. All right, basically fiduciary duty means you have to treat the person who you're protecting's interest as higher than your own. That's the bottom line. That is the most stringent standard of conduct. And basically, the SEC said the Board of Officers and Directors, based on these judicial precedents, had a fiduciary duty. And Harrison correctly points out that the court said, "Feh, no. It's a legal determination. We make the call. We say there isn't one." But now you're telling me they reached the exact same decision, and now the court says it's okay?
Right.
Why?
So they're basically kind of referring to the rulemaking ability of the agency. They were saying that unlike a court, they don't have to rely on past judicial decisions. They actually have this ability to kind of do a quasi-legislative kind of thing and come up with a new law. Mm-hmm. So they defer to that in this case.
So I'm still not quite sure I follow you there. So essentially, it looks like a trial proceeding. It looks like an adjudication. It looks and smells and feels with oral testimony, advocacy, cross-examination, creation of a record, just like a proceeding that's done in the court. And the Supreme Court says, fooled you. That's not what's going on here. I know, that wasn't a question, but I'm hoping for a response. Well, no, you could say, "Professor, that's dead wrong," or "Professor, yeah, I think you really captured that."
Can you repeat the question?
No! Essentially, the Supreme Court was saying it looks and smells and feels just like a trial, but it ain't. Is that correct?
I suppose.
Okay. So essentially, what's really going on here is that it looks like a trial, but it's actually a rule-making proceeding.
Right.
Even though it's embodied on the hapless victim of this one particular corporation and its board, okay? And essentially, the SEC reached exactly the same decision. They just shifted the rationale for it. And the court says that's fine. All right, what is it about the bases that the SEC chose for its decision this time around that made the difference?
Well, because now they're basing it on the Holding Company Act, and so before we're seeing it, they're kind of just like filling the gaps in the act and using that as a basis, which is, I guess, just, that's just within their power because,
right, it's within their power because, I'm sorry, I wasn't sure if you tailed off or if you had actually finished your thought.
I just trailed off.
Sarah's going to be like, "Well, I'm glad I'm not reading now today." Okay. So, let's sort of mush along then. Is it the nature of the problem and the goal of the process that matters here? So in a sense, it's not a lawsuit with adversarial parties necessarily. What it really is that you look at the problem underneath. And what is it about the nature of this problem that makes it more suitable to an agency making a decision that's really not judicial in nature, but really more of a rulemaking proceeding? And does it matter that it's complex?
I'm not sure.
I mean, towards the end of the opinion, don't they describe some of the things about the nature of the issue before the SEC that makes the SEC the better person to make the call here? Let me rephrase the question, maybe this will help. What was it about the SEC's way it decided this case that the Supreme Court said, "Well, this makes it worthy of us deferring to you"? But in a way they wouldn't, but the district court would know what to do.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Put it this way, if this was a slip and fall case, pretty straightforward, simple issues, facts are driven, individual parties. What we're talking about here is something that is a highly complex issue. I think we all agree based on the description of the case, this is not an easy slip of the tongue. This is also an issue that's committed by Congress to the discretion of the agency. This is also one that has policy dimensions to it. The decision to make here is going to affect a vast swath of industry. Is your subconscious starting to bubble and percolate now with some of the things that Bert was talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. So essentially then, because of the fact that the agency has discretion allocated by the statute, because the agency has expertise, because the problem itself is complex, because it has policy dimensions built into it, the court basically said, we don't care whether we agree with you. We don't say whether we reach the same result, because in the prior case, we actually reached the opposite result. But we are going to give you a deferential standard of review. Now I feel like I've gone past questioning to what would they call leading cross-examination. But have I captured what you would think about this case so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So with that in mind, does it matter that since this is an adversarial adjudicatory proceeding, that this poor company basically is getting slapped with a new rule in their case that they couldn't possibly have known?
Does it matter?
It's a retroactive ruling. Basically, let's be honest with ourselves, this company got screwed.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think they kind of just looked past the fact that it was retroactive. Just said that it was already.
Well, I think you may have already answered this one as well, though, haven't you? Remember what you said earlier? The agency was actually implementing a statute, not really deciding a simple case between two adversarial parties.
Right.
And the statute drives the decision. And if the statute is interpreted by the agency to have this particular interpretation, it looks back. You can retroactively interpret a statute as long as the mischief created by that retroactive look is outweighed by the policy benefits promulgated by the statute. And I just highlight that because isn't that sort of the case with every adjudicated proceeding? Somebody is finding out too late what the law is, because they're the ones making the law. Congratulations, you volunteered. So what the court basically says is, you're right. Doesn't matter. As long as the statute's goals are achieved and the agency's discharging its role in implementing that statute, and the benefits outweigh the mischief created by someone. So, but with that, I can't resist. I wasn't going to, but you mentioned the dissent.
Yeah.
I was curious, what did you think of the dissent? And by the way, I'll ask that generally to the class. Normally, I will freely confess to you, it's really tempting to sort of say, oh, it's dissent, I get to skip these pages. This is one by Justice Jackson, one of the most interesting justices to ever sit on the court. He also is the one who resigned from the court to sit in the Nuremberg tribunals after World War II. This is written some of the most brilliant opinions thinking in constitutional law. So his dissents actually are ones that are worth paying some attention to, and he also is a wonderful writer. So with that in mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, he definitely had a point that it could be seen as people were just changing their mind, like they just had the fundamental change in prevailing philosophy, because they were just kind of working their way toward getting the result that they want, changing their and so, I mean, I think that's at least a good point to talk about. I don't know if he's necessarily right.
So you are amused but not persuaded.
Yeah.
Okay. I have to admit, I like anybody whose opinion says the more you explain it, the less I understand it. Yeah. Sometimes I've had that experience reading Supreme Court opinions. The bottom line here is Justice Jackson's fundamental point is, where's the law? The agency's deciding it on the fly. It's fundamentally at odds with an adjudicatory proceeding to let the decision maker have that power, to essentially call the shots on its own behalf when you have the party in front of it trying to ask for a determination within law, actually. Having said that, Bottom line, Jackson lost. Chenery is fundamental administrative agency law. Notice the date on this decision, 1947. This is before the Administrative Procedure Act. What that means is a lot of the things you see in Chenery are now law of the land because they were incorporated almost verbatim into the Administrative Procedure Act. In particular, the idea that there should be deference for the decision-making of the body of the administrative agency, and that the court may or may not agree with this decision, but nonetheless will not reverse it unless it was arbitrary, which is the first instance you see arbitrary and capricious in the case law that was later embodied into the Administrative Procedure Act. It also talks about, to a certain extent, that there's a substantial evidence standard of review, that the agency can't just make it up. They've got to have a record, a contemporaneous record, that supports the decision in a concise and reasonable way. So, pausing. This is kind of our base. Now we're going to start jazz quartet, improvising on the themes. Is everyone sort of comfortable with the idea of Chenery? That the court has decided ultimately that even in an adjudicatory proceeding that looks an awful lot like a trial in any other court, that there's still deference granted to the agency by the court, that deference takes the form of essentially an arbitrary standard of review. The agency has to act arbitrarily, not just be wrong. And that it has to be limited to a record before that agency, the substantial evidence standard of review. Because this will be a mantra to you. You will be muttering it in your sleep before the final, I assure you. Okay? Because this is also embodied directly in the APA now. So now, let's sort of see what happens when you start permutating. Is that a word? Working through permutations of it. Which brings us to our second case in Harrison. Since, unfortunately, we have an odd number of cases, and since these two are so close, I'm going to ask you to do double duty. After gone through Chenery, too, can you talk a little bit about our next case, which is the NLRB versus Bell Aerospace Company case?
Okay, so the NLRB, they determined that manager employees had a particular exception under the National Labor Relations Act. And basically, the issue was
that's right. Well, while you're looking and digesting, I'll do a little bit of background, and then you can then give me the pithy punchline to get to the end. This is a case explaining why you guys will never, ever get overtime in your law firms, your corporations, where you work, or a government agency. The National Labor Relations Act exempts certain classes of employees by statute from the protections of the NLRA, including, which we'll talk about in a later case today, your entitlement to overtime. If you work extra, you get extra pay, or limits the number of hours that you work. Usually, managerial employees are deemed to be exempt. It is a sad truth that usually is a category that includes attorneys. So, sad, but then again, in your happy pursuit of $2,500 a year, it's nice to know that at least the NLRB, at least thought about you. So with that in mind, Harrison, we're talking about then who is an exempt employee from the NLRA, and what happened when the NLRB decided to take a whack at it.
Right, so they said that the managerial employees were exempt, and I think I just read this one way too fast.
That's okay. Well, I'll do a dangerous thing and just simply open it up to the class. Particularly any of you who are interested in doing employment law, this might be a good chance to sort of dip your toe into the water. Essentially, with the NLRB, let me just ask the fundamental question. This is an easy one. Who won? Okay.
NLRB.
Thank you, James. What's the story here?
just refer back to Chenery 2 and said that the board has a lot of discretion in deciding things of this nature. And they kind of blurred lines between adjudication and rulemaking, and that they're able to do things through adjudication, which is kind of strange because it doesn't give people a whole lot of notice.
But Chenery 2, like you said, directly talked about that.
Yeah.
So hopefully all of you who read this case had a similar reaction, which is, why are we bothering reading this case? It just repeats Chenery 2. Well, it's because, like your favorite video games, it has an Easter egg buried in it. At least video games still have Easter eggs buried in them, don't they? Okay, good. So with that in mind, take a look at the escape hatches that the court sees in this opinion to get out of Chenery 2. It doesn't say they apply here, but it hints at cases in the future that might not qualify for this deferential standard, even in an adjudicatory setting. In particular, the whispers of trouble. One, adverse consequences ensuing from reliance are substantial. Notice it also says that this case doesn't present a situation where there's new liability for past actions. While they acknowledge it can have a retroactive effect, they seem to be troubled that there's a certain level beyond which the agency can't go. And third, it says there's no fines or penalties involved here. So this case is the warning flag. This is the one where if you were stuck with a client who was sunk by Chenery 2, that this case offers you a way to argue, well, even though it might be, let's be honest with ourselves, dicta, NLRB versus Bell Aerospace gives you the prospect of saying that your case poses exactly one of those three conditions. And if you can prove one of them, the Supreme Court might not defer to the agency despite Chenery 2. And Harrison, I'm sorry, I kind of got carried away. So I guess I leave one question then. Would you agree with that assessment, or do you have a different take on the case? Because believe me, I'm open for any other creative approaches.
That makes sense. I guess I'd really interested in why because it's just dicta, like why it's so important. But I guess the way that you put it, yeah, I can see how it differentiates itself from Chenery 2.
I know one of the comments from the mid-course survey were people who said, this book, I might want to think about a different book next year because Professor Eskridge tends to have a little bit of an agenda, talk about things he likes on the theory side. The silent agenda here is he has a different theoretical question in mind, which makes him like this case a lot, which is, what standard of review do you apply to a decision by the agency to use an adjudicatory proceeding as opposed to notice and comment rulemaking? Is it just like the decisions itself, arbitrary and capricious? Or is this sort of earlier decision subject to a different standard of review? Interesting question. I will tell you, to my knowledge, no court has wrestled with it. It's on the horizon. For now, NLRB versus Bell Aerospace is really more a case for our practical purposes of dealing with real life issues. It's the case that points to the escape routes that doesn't take them. Does that make sense for everybody? Now, so having said that, let me offer a couple of quick codas. One, as your book points out, this is very much true. What we're talking about is sort of the rare exception. Your practice as a regulatory attorney is going to be overwhelmingly focused on notice and comment rulemaking. It is fairly rare to have adjudicatory proceedings to set new regulatory standards. A couple of agencies tend to do them more than others, the FAA, the FCC, the NLRB, but you're going to be dealing with anybody from the Department of Transportation to the Department of Interior to EPA, SEC, in many respects, they're going to be notice and comment, not this kind of trial type proceeding. Two important exceptions for those of you looking at business development when you graduate. One, state law is different. As I mentioned in our last class, for example, some states are just love contested permit, contested hearing proceedings, which are full trial proceedings. If you want to get trial experience and you are not sanguine about your prospects of getting to court, agencies are a great place to sort of earn your spurs. Number two, there's a creeping change afoot. Namely, a lot of agencies have kind of gotten sick and tired of notice and comment rulemaking. And I'm not just saying this personal opinion, I think you'll find a lot of people will share this perspective, where a lot of times it's actually easier for them to pick a fight, to be sued, to end up in an adjudicatory proceeding, and then use that as a platform to settle by voluntary agreement with the other party, and then incorporate into the settlement the new policy that they want, and essentially lock it up. So, say for example, you are with a presidential administration that is in its last couple of years. You have sweeping changes that you want to implement. And this, by the way, is policy neutral. Common, it's done in the Reagan administration, both Bush administrations, Clinton, and it's happening now with the Obama administration. You have what's called a sue and settle strategy, where essentially the lawsuit is a vehicle to lock into place through a consent agreement that can only be modified through very fairly high standard of review, future regulatory policy, and avoid, to some extent, the need for notice and comment rulemaking. So in a sense, that's like a revival of our old adjudicatory model. It's just sort of done in a strange kind of doppelganger way. And matter of fact, it's so prevalent, Congress is actually considering multiple bills to stop the practice.
I guess I'm just a little confused on that. So you're saying the agency will sue a company or somebody to use a settlement agreement as a precedent? That's allowed?
Either way, they actually typically are sued by somebody. Yeah. Oftentimes, somebody who may be philosophically aligned with the agency position, and then other parties intervene, but then you settle the case and lock up the consent agreement.
So
this is in a federal court, not in Japan.
The precedent will be like an agency policy or something, and then I just don't see how like a settlement between parties would apply to future other parties necessarily.
That's an excellent point, but remember you can sue over rules, not over just your particular facility. If, for example, the Department of Interior passes a new rule limiting the way that you can actually use parks for grazing. Remember, what was his name, Clinton Bundy? Who, by the way, is still grazing his cattle on federal land. Having said that, DOI publishes a new rule. They know it's going to cause a controversy, and they're sued. But they're not just sued by the farmers. They're also sued by other agencies, I'm sorry, other NGOs, like, say, Sierra Club. What will happen is sometimes you will see the agency negotiate a settlement that incorporates what they want in the rule, and then lock in a consent decree so it can't be overturned easily by the next administration that comes to the door. And a lot of times that consent decree process is faster and simpler than doing a full-fledged notice and comment, which might last for years and trigger its own litigation down the road. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Sure. Any other questions about that? If anyone's interested in that, I have reams of information about it. It's going to be a very active issue this Congress and next Congress. So with that, that was bin one. Let's go to bin two. Now we're going to talk about another really important hot issue that's affecting regulatory practice right now. Namely, not all rules look alike. The Administrative Procedure Act expressly draws a line between regular notice and comment rules that have general applicability and are the law of the land, and the administrative law, as opposed to regs light. Interpretive rules or statements, general statements of policy. That second category flies under radar. The agency does not have to go through notice and comment rulemaking to promulgate an interpretive rule. The Administrative Procedure Act expressly exempts those rules from that process. Although the Administrative Procedure Act does say if these rules have general applicability, you still have to publish them in the Federal Register, but frankly, that's no big deal. Agency's happy to publish anything in the Federal Register. What they don't want is something that they take comments on and get sued over. So it oftentimes becomes incredibly important on whether or not a rule is notice and comment or interpretive or just a statement of policy. Another variation of this is whether or not it's guidance, which is even one step down further. So in particular, for those of you who are, you know, love the details, we're talking about in particular the Administrative Procedure Act, section 553BA. And if you want to leaf to the appendix at some point when you have nothing to do on a Friday night, it's there. Now, with that in mind, let me sort of say then, it's easy to muddle things up here, and it actually makes a difference. Notice of conduct rules are one thing, but the other two I just described are not just mushed together in one basket. General statements of policy are not the same as interpretive rules. And we'll talk a little bit about how you distinguish them, but for now I'll just sort of give you a litmus test, which is an interpretive rule simply says how the agency is going to interpret a rule or law that already exists going forward. A general statement of policy simply says, as a matter of its discretion going forward, the agency is going to choose to follow a certain path that's allowed for it to choose of its own discretion under the statute. It's not bound to do it. So since it has an area to play, it's just going to be fair warning, this is what it's going to do within its freedom to choose. So with that in mind, we do have a couple of cases. Sorry, James, do you have your hand up?
Yeah, for the interpretive rules, are those, can the court look to those if they have a question before them?
Ah, be careful. You may have just volunteered for one of our cases just now, because that's exactly the issue the courts are wrestling with right now. But since you volunteered earlier, I won't leave it. We're doing it to the play. But let's, just to make sure we don't miss our opportunity, let's take a look at the Supreme Court case that was served up to us hot and fresh last month. This is the Perez versus Mortgage Bankers Association case. And since we're sort of moving left to right, and sadly, Ben, you draw the short straw on this one. Okay, so this is one of those fun opinions where there's a lot of subtext here, but Justice Sotomayor, as always, is a very clear writer. That's part of her greatest strength as a jurist. Can you give us a quick sense of what were they fighting about over in this case?
Basically, court itself is fighting over how much deference to give an agency. But in this particular case, they're debating what an interpretive rule is, basically.
Okay. What's the setting for that fight? What's the issue that the NLRB has served up to them?
The Department of Labor, NLRB, they had kept changing who was for mortgage loan officers, if they qualified for an exemption or not when it came to minimum wage, maximum hour requirements, and they kept going back and forth. And eventually they came out and said, well, these don't apply to mortgage loan officers, and then all the mortgage companies.
Mm-hmm. So essentially then, mortgage officers are either like managerial agents or they're basically salesmen, basically. Then the rules apply to them just like any other hourly employee. And you said the agency went back and forth.
So they had interpreted differently over different times.
Okay.
Over like a 15,
20
year span.
Well, this sort of, cutting to the chase. I mean, if I remember correctly, in 2006, they changed the regulation. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then after that, they changed the interpretation. But essentially an opinion letter they'd issued on how they're going, they issued a new opinion letter on how they interpret this new reg.
Right.
And that's when they suddenly said, Shazam! These mortgage bankers are basically, they are going to be considered to be outside the protections of the law. But then, a couple of years later, did you notice the dates involved?
I don't have an exact.
Okay, well basically, notice after a new administration was in place, Shazam back! They changed their interpretation even though the 2006 regulation was unchanged. And of course, they got sued. So the question I think, and I'll serve it up so you can tell me what Sotomayor's thinking was on this, was essentially, what sort of deference does a court have to pay? Well, let me rephrase that. What sort of limits are on the agency's ability to essentially walk away from its prior interpretive rule to change course?
Basically, she says there's not really any other than that arbitrary standard that if they want to change their interpretive rule, they can do it whenever they can, basically.
And what's the basis for saying that they have that power?
Because in the APA itself, it lists the minimum requirements for certain things, like for the notice of comment, but it exempts these type of actions specifically. And she goes on and says, well, courts can't add additional protections that aren't in the APA. Mm-hmm.
And that's the heart of it. It's an amazingly simple opinion in some respects. Essentially, Sotomayor is basically saying, that's it. The APA spells it out. Not only is that the beginning, not only is that the alpha, it's the omega. The courts can't step in afterwards and say, that's a good procedure, but we want to add an extra step to make it more protective. Hopefully we'll get to another case called Vermont Yankee, which says the same thing. But essentially, the courts are limited in their ability to force agencies to jump through additional hoops. Now, this, however, got all the way to the Supreme Court and triggered this opinion, which seems to imply there is something in place before this opinion that might have said something different.
Right. There was another case, a paralyzed veterans case.
What a great title for a case. It was just like, oof. That would, along with Excelsior Underwear, what a great case for today. Anyway, keep going.
Paralyzed veterans basically said that you can't, if you allow an agency to make a fundamental change of its interpretation without notice and comment, that defeats the whole purpose of the APA to begin with, so you can't allow them to do that.
Right, so let us make sure I understand the full kind of weird vibe of that new rule. Essentially, the agency publishes its own reg, it then interprets its own reg, and then by doing so, when it did that first rule, it was totally free to skip notice and comment rulemaking. The APA said so. A few years later, they decide to change, and since people have relied on that earlier interpretation, they're locked in. It's essentially, it's amending that earlier regulation in Shazam here. Notice and comment rulemaking is required for your earlier exempt interpretive rule. Hopefully some of you in the back row are now going, huh? That doesn't make much sense. Bottom line here, and this is why we carved those cases out the middle of your reading today, paralyzed veterans is dead. That's a terrible way to put that. Let me rephrase that. That case doctrine is no longer viable. The reason I wanted to make sure that we paid attention to it, though, is you'll notice, once again, there's another debate brewing. And I'll point you to two things you might want to watch from this opinion. It'll pop up again later in the semester. There's reference to a case called Auer. I won't go into it now, but this case essentially says that the same way the courts defer to agencies when agencies are interpreting a law that they're responsible for, Auer says the agencies get the same deferential standard when they're reviewing their own regulations. Not the law, the regs. You'll notice that the Supreme Court, it's a 9-0 opinion. It's incredibly fractured because so many justices hate this rule. They've been inviting certiorari petitions to overturn it, literally inviting in the opinions. So I would not be surprised if they grant cert while we're in class to overturn the Auer doctrine. Now, notice as well, for those of you who really want to sort of see where the storm clouds are brewing, as always, Scalia writes an entertaining dissent. But here, take a look, because the other big case, which I've been hinting at repeatedly, it's coming now in the final part of the class, the Chevron case, which sets that deferential standard of review, he thinks Chevron should be reversed. And is now campaigning within the bench to build support for that position. So for those of you looking for Supreme Court case that you might want to write about or get involved with, that one's on deck. You want to think about that. With that in mind, anything else, Ben, in terms of this particular Supreme Court opinion you'd like to add?
Okay.
I will also say, if you are really masochistic, Alito's opinion is an interesting and informative, but very much minority opinion. So as opposed to Scalia, it's sort of Justice Thomas as well. I'm not sure that's really worth a whole lot of your time. So with that in mind, the key thing here is we're still talking about interpretive rules versus general statements of policy and what sort of process agencies have to go through to get them out the door and what sorts of weight they get once they get out the door. So we've talked about, to a certain extent, interpretive rules. And the new decision in the Perez case essentially says an interpretive rule is an interpretive rule is an interpretive rule. It doesn't matter if the agency decides to change course, the APA still sets the standard. And that standard essentially says no notice and comment. Extremely deferential to the agency. And notice it doesn't talk about the other half of that basket, general statements of policy. And I tried to give you a quick litmus test of the distinction between the two, but now let's talk a little bit about, in particular, the case that we have, our final case for today, that talks about the distinction between those and what it means. And of course, that means, Cameron, you know there's no place left. You're the last person standing, so you were going to draw this one. Can you give us a little sense about the FAA case?
So the case involves a challenge by a group of employees who work on airlines and some other interested parties, essentially saying that the FAA's new interpretation or application of a rule violates a circular that they put out, which the FAA contends a policy statement, but of course the plaintiffs contend it's a rule. And the idea was they have been doing a lot of evacuation tests on planes for when they would increase the capacity by 5%. At least generally that's what they held. Mm-hmm. So they actually have to build a mock up of the plane. Everyone runs out of the plane in under 9 seconds. But people were getting injured during these tests. So the FAA said, we don't need to do that anymore. Technology's advanced. The airlines can provide us with that information to avoid having people trip over each other running out of planes. So that's the whole argument centered around.
And by the way, very concise, right to the point. I will say though, reading this case gave me a chill because I spent a lot of time in airplanes, and I was just imagining having to go through a drill on getting off the plane in 9 seconds. Yeah. Imagine the chaos involved in that, and jumping on the inflatable slide and going down. So having said that, this is the case. Now, who was it that sued the FAA over this new rule that essentially says you don't have to jump down the slide anymore?
It was a group of, like, it talked about airlines, like workers and some other interested parties. Let me, as far as who specifically, I can check.
No, essentially, you captured it. Essentially, it's a coalition. Pilots, passengers, air stewards. It was interesting that they opposed this change in approach so that they want to have to force people to jump down the actual slide and make sure it actually works, as long as the capacity of the plane is up over 5%, which was a prior policy. So with that in mind, I'll sort of ask once again my favorite question. Who won for the D.C. Circuit in this case?
They held that policy statements, in this case, they ruled in favor of the FAA, and it was on the grounds that the language of the circular cabin them in, where it didn't restrict their action as this will automatically happen if these circumstances occur.
So why does that matter?
Essentially, if it was a rule, it would be more absolute and restrictive on the agency's action or application of the statute for plane inspection, plane safety. But if it gave discretion, then it would indicate essentially no intent to be bound or no absolute standard to be applied in future cases. So they found for the FAA on those grounds.
And so why did they conclude that the latest circular actually gave the FAA discretion? What was it about the language of that circular?
The language allowed the FAA to say, it didn't say that, it still gave them the choice if they wanted to, if the data wasn't available by the airline manufacturer, just kind of snap back and say, if you have over 5%, do an actual evacuation drill on your plane.
So essentially, the circular was written in such a way as to say, it doesn't use the words shall, it says may. It doesn't say must, it says can choose. It sets out alternative pathways that the agency can act upon occurrence of certain conditions. So essentially, is it just phraseology?
They looked at the actual meaning of what they, like, plain meaning of the circular, determine if it was, meant to be a rule or meant to be a policy statement.
Okay. So it's a question of intent?
I think so.
Okay.
In this case, it reflects what the agency was trying to do.
So if a circular was written in permissive language, but the agency's intent was to basically always do one particular thing, I never require a slide test again, does that matter?
Based on the inclusion of the reference back to the APA, it doesn't really.
Would it be relevant to you to find out that the FAA has never again ordered a single slide test demonstration?
Not as someone who would want my planes to be safe.
I'm sure it's still safe. The FAA, you can trust the FAA.
Of course. Why wouldn't I? But as opposed to the application of the APA, it doesn't really matter.
Okay.
As far as that goes. It's kind of like an end around in a way.
It's basically, because the phrasing of this circular allowed the agency to call it, to label it, a general statement of policy, or at worst, an interpretive ruling. Essentially, they step off the track. We're done. No need to go through notice and comment, no need to worry about worrying what the public says, no need to worry about litigation over it. You're going to look just like if you were in a witness box in a trial. Is that a question, counselor? Am I correct in saying it that way?
Sure. I think you captured that well.
Thank you very much. At some point, during the semester, someone's going to say it. For some reason, I think it's probably going to be Travis, will say, no, you got that all wrong. Okay, so having said that, I am sort of building up to a point. What I'd like to do, Cameron, is just sort of take that, package it, put it in the shelf for a second. I want to ask one other question before we get to the big question, which is, this is obviously a case decided before Paramedics versus Department of Labor. Paralyzed veterans is still good law. Here we have a classic case, an agency flip-flopping, where they had a prior interpretation of this rule, and then they changed course. Why didn't paralyzed veterans sink the trade groups in this case?
They felt that it wasn't interpreting a regulation. Mm-hmm. Rather, it was they kind of looked at a policy statement as a different instrument than actually interpreting a regulation. And they held that paralyzed veterans were for interpretations of regulations and not applicable to policy statements.
So not only is the label this get out of jail free card for notice and comment, the sub-label that this is a general statement of policy rather than an interpretive rule is also an escape hatch from the paralyzed veterans doctrine. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
So labels matter, and labels are predicated on the language the agency chooses to put to its circular?
I'd say yes in terms of the labeling, but then also in terms of kind of the process that the agency went through. Mm-hmm. Since it did do the comment notice period, it kind of reinforces that they weren't trying to do a interpretive regulation type thing.
Well, actually, didn't they get comment on this? They called it a general statement policy, but then they published it in the Federal Register and they invited public comment on it. Isn't that kind of weird?
Okay. I can see that. I think probably because of the, they essentially did a hybrid action because they changed their announced policy while including comment and notice, but then claiming that it wasn't a regulation interpretation. I guess it's when the court's opinion is reading or discussing what happened, they say that they don't have to do that.
Mm-hmm. So basically, even though they chose voluntarily to go through this extra step, it didn't change the label underlying the process. That this circular is still ultimately just a general statement of policy. And that's because it uses discretionary language that doesn't in any way cabin the discretion of the agency. Because I want to make sure we're really clear about that, because now I'm going to step back I'm going to ask everyone this question. This is not a law, a question related to the casebook materials. Think like an agency lawyer. I mean, we now have the Hudson versus FAA case, which makes it abundantly clear that as long as you use certain language, you get to qualify for certain exemptions. You now have a hairy, nasty issue that your agency is facing. And I'll just pause. You know, this is like an improv comedy night. You know, I'm going to ask the audience to throw an idea out. What's an issue currently for an agency that's controversial? Really? Okay. Any particular variety?
Corn.
Okay. That's a great example. So let me put it this way then. My apologies, but if anyone knows more about this, please jump in and correct me as I go along. I'm always reluctant to talk about genetics in front of folks who have PhDs in the topic. But there is currently varieties of corn that are genetically engineered to include a naturally occurring insecticide that is derived from certain types of bacteria. Essentially, you don't have to spray a pesticide on them. It kills the bugs dead when they try to eat it. Unfortunately, it turns out that this BT toxin that's been incorporated in certain varieties of genetically modified corn is now alleged to not only be killing pests, but it's wiping out monarch butterfly populations. As they fly from Mexico up to Canada every year, millions of monarch butterflies, it appears that there's a substantial loss of populations of monarch butterflies, in part because of these genetically modified plants, including corn. There's actually a discussion and a lawsuit to force the listing of the monarch butterflies as an endangered species, in part because of this issue. So, we now are the Department of Agriculture. It turns out that there is a provision which the Department of Agriculture can be petitioned and forced to issue regulations that would limit the planting of this type of pesticide-laden corn in a way that would not harm indigenous species. You, as the agency lawyer, know that this is coming. It hasn't happened yet. There's a possibility for the Department of Agriculture to control the situation by stepping forward now. There are currently rules already in place in the books that govern the testing and deployment of genetically modified organisms into the environment. They've already been used. They've been applied for varieties of species. You can, one, issue a new rule saying thou shalt not plant corn in certain times of the year when butterflies are flying by, or you will take steps to prevent butterflies from being impacted by the corn. Two, you can issue an interpretive rule that interprets the existing laws and existing regulations to say that those requirements are already inherent in the existing rules. Or three, you can say, as a matter of general policy, we are going to mandate, going forward, as far within our discretion, that farmers who wish to receive federal funding assistance, particularly for like crop assistance, must comply with these requirements. Given Hudson versus FAA, what would you advise your client, the agency, to do?
First of all, for the matter of general policy, the way that you stated it, you used language saying, like, farmers must do this,
okay,
which makes it, which would maybe open the door for an argument that's not a statement of general policy, that's a rule.
Okay. Is that a legal touchstone we must adhere to, or is that just bad drafting on my part?
That's what I, one of the things that I got out of the Hudson case, is that the language.
So how would you say it otherwise?
Rather than must say, farmers who wish to receive funding assistance should.
Or may. Yeah, you've captured it correctly. And isn't this system an invitation to game the process? If you're an agency lawyer, wouldn't you go to great lengths to put something in the interpretive rule or general policy statement box if you can possibly avoid notice and comment rulemaking?
can the agency do that, like your third example? Could they tie like your taking a certain action with you receiving federal farm aid?
Let me say something very important. That is totally fictional. It is premised on the notion that the Department of Agriculture has the discretion to grant or withhold loans. The law is not built that way, as you know. There's a certain, you can qualify for the loans despite the agency's discretion, whether they like you or not. But you're right. And so I didn't mean to jump in on you. Is that what you were going to ask?
Yeah.
Okay. So let me just offer this thought to you. I am not making this up. There is a very pronounced tendency on agencies, and again, I think I'm being fair in saying this, to try and use tools that can achieve their goals that don't expose the agency to attacks in the Administrative Procedure Act. Those tools include, rather than promulgating a rule, promulgating guidance. Those tools include using interpretive rules whenever possible, rather than an actual rule, notice and comment rule. To give one example, there was an interpretive rule that the Clean Air Act didn't apply to greenhouse gases. Hugely controversial, but it's an interpretive rule, no notice and comment rulemaking required. That means, essentially, if you were to look at the real world, the vast bulk of determinations by the agency are guidance, letters, opinions, circulars. The nitty-gritty, meat and potato, nuts and bolts, actions of the agency, the vast majority are going to be done at this lower level, which escapes APA review. As you get more and more serious or broad-ranging applicability, you'll see general policy. Then you'll see interpretive rules. And this, at the peak, the smallest number is actual notice and comment. And I will tell you, you can have some very hairy fights with the agency over whether or not they have something that they call a guidance or a policy is actually really a rule, and you end up litigating those cases. So with that in mind for today, rather than getting to that hugely entertaining field of practice, I'll simply say, takeaway, there are differences under the Administrative Procedure Act between the varieties of rules. The ones we talked about today, particularly general policy statements and interpretive rules, get favorable special treatment and do not go to notice and comment, but still have some type of deferential review by the courts. So with that in mind, any questions, thoughts, ideas, or suggestions before I yield the podium to Professor Kumar? Okay, next week, we shift gears again. We're going to be now moving to supervision of the agency state. And not only just supervision by the courts, we're going to start with Congress and the President, which means we're going to look at politics in this rawest and ugliest state. So with that, for those of you I won't see on Friday, have a great weekend, everyone else, and catch up with you soon.